Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So in both my talks today, I'm going to talk about Flannery and like do some philosophy and theology, and then I'm just going to like get into a story. So that's how this talk is going to go as well. But first, I'm just going to tell you some things about her life. Okay, so Mary Flannery O'Connor was born on March 25th, 1925 in Savannah, Georgia, right in the heart of the city's Irish Catholic enclave and a hospital run by the Sisters of Mercy. Mary Flannery was the precocious, intense, quirky, and artistically gifted only child to Regina and Edward O'Connor. Little Mary was painfully shy and antisocial, but she enjoyed a rich interior life, which she brought to life in both drawings and stories. As a young girl, she was educated by the strict and pious nuns at St. Vincent's Grammar School, but she was not a very good student. She abhorred traditional displays of piety, and she spoke disdainfully of, quote, nun-inspired doings. In 1937, when she was only 12, her father, with whom she was especially close, was diagnosed with lupus. At 13, her father moved the family out to Milledgeville in rural Georgia. This was the site of her mother's family's stately antebellum mansion and her uncle's 550-acre dairy farm, Andalusia. O'Connor spent countless hours there drawing, writing, and tending to the birds, especially the peafowl. Mary disdained the trappings of Southern girlhood that her mother had tried unsuccessfully to impose on her. And Milledgeville was farther away from those pressures, and it was also full of the strange country people that would come to populate O'Connor's fiction. In 1941, when she was 16, Mary's father succumbed to lupus, which was the end of her childhood. She describes the loss in a way that I think is an early clue to her later approach to art, and also the lens through which she understood her own Catholic faith. So this is a quote. "The reality of death has come upon us, and a consciousness of the power of God has broken our complacency like a bullet in the side. A sense of the dramatic, of the tragic, of the infinite has descended upon us, filling us with grief, but even above grief, wonder." In her father's early death, the person with whom she felt the deepest kinship and affection, she was able to see the work of grace, but that grace was painful. Her insight that God's grace can be violent, dark, and disruptive, that it can shock one out of one's complacency and comfort in order to lead them to a deeper perception of reality and the mystery of being through awe and wonder, this will become an enduring theme of her fiction. In high school, Mary began to stand out for her writing, but it wasn't always well received. A classmate of hers once wrote that being in creative writing class with Mary Flannery was sheer torture. I remember she wrote very strange stories with weird characters. So I guess this goes way back. In 1942, Mary began to study at the Georgia State College for Women, a progressive school in Milledgeville. One of the formative moments of her college years was a course she took in philosophy. It was a survey of modern philosophers. The hero of the course was René Descartes, who saw the world as purely material and devoid of value or meaning. The perspective of the professor in the class was a sort of familiar secular humanism. Flannery was unimpressed with this perspective and took to arguing regularly with her professor, even going so far as to diagram the differences between Thomas Aquinas and modernism on the blackboard. By Mary's lights, modernism had blinded people to the most central features of reality by its narrow focus on the material and the quantifiable. For Mary, by contrast, nature was the site for grace. It was therefore both intrinsically meaningful and good. It was not just so much stuff for us to dominate and control however we might will. As much as they disagreed on these matters of substance, her philosophy professor recognized her prodigious talents as a writer and a thinker, and he encouraged her to apply to graduate school at the University of Iowa. So she set her sights on a journalism degree. O'Connor was accepted into the School of Journalism, but immediately upon arriving, she decided that she simply must meet the head of the newly formed writer's workshop, a man named Paul Engel. However, her rural Georgia accent was so thick that he could not understand a word she said to him. He eventually hands her a pad of paper on which she writes the following: "My name is Flannery O'Connor. I am not a journalist. Can I come to the writer's workshop?" Upon reading one of her stories, Engel accepts her immediately. Around this time, Mary begins to sign all of her writings as Flannery O'Connor, Flannery being her middle name. Of the change of her name, she asked, "Well, who is likely to buy the stories of an Irish washerwoman?" It was certainly not lost on her that Flannery is a gender-neutral name, and she would sometimes brag that she had received rejections from journals addressed to Mr. Flannery O'Connor. Whatever we might make of her gender's influence on her thinking and writing, O'Connor openly and intentionally flouted the norms of womanhood that were pressed upon her from all sides at the time. Also around this time, O'Connor began to read the great European novelists voraciously. She began to work very diligently on the formal aspects of her craft of writing. She also met many famous writers and poets who passed through the workshop to share their manuscripts. After her time in Iowa, she took up a very prestigious summer writing residency at Yaddo. So that's like a famous artist colony in upstate New York. Robert Lowell, the famous poet, would later join her there, and he and Flannery became fast and very close friends. Lowell helped connect Flannery to prominent literary Catholics like Robert Giraud at Harcourt Brace and Robert and Sally Fitzgerald. And this helped her once she moves to New York City to advance her career as a writer. Flannery hated New York, right? Although her famous friends were happy to talk her up at cocktail parties in Manhattan, her temperament and background made her especially ill-suited to thrive there. And her famous quip about the Eucharist, that if it's just a symbol, to hell with it, that's a scene from a cocktail party in Manhattan. After a short time in New York City and an even shorter time living with the Fitzgeralds in Connecticut, Flannery has to return to Milledgeville, back home with her mother. And that's because she's now been diagnosed with lupus, the same disease that took her father. And she knew that she would have to go back under her mother's care, which presumably was a bit unhappy for her. Upon her return to the southern countryside, Flannery devotes herself completely to writing, painting, and to the hundreds of birds on the farm, including about 70 peafowl. Her first novel, Wise Blood, was published in 1952. She was 27. Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea and Steinbeck's East of Eden were published that same year, just to kind of give you a timestamp for that. Critical reactions were very mixed. As was the case in high school, critics couldn't understand why her characters were so darkly comic and freakish, or why her works contained so much seemingly senseless violence. Her publisher remarked that they all recognized her power, but they missed her point. Now, the publication of a short story called A Good Man is Hard to Find, which was the next year, secured her status as one of the great writers of her generation. Her publisher compared the story to the best of Hemingway and Melville. By the end of her relatively short writing career, O'Connor had published 2 novels and 32 short stories. She died on August 3rd, 1964, at the age of 39, while she was busy at work on her 3rd novel, Why Did the Heathen Rage, and her final stories, including Parker's Back, which I want to talk about later today. So that's just like a very brief overview of her life. And now I want to talk about her hillbilly Thomism. So the wonder that Flannery experienced at her father's death had led her to study theology. She confessed to her friends that she had the habit of reading the 700-page Modern Library Introduction to St. Thomas Aquinas before bed every evening. And she claimed that she read a lot of theology because it made her writing bolder. She was often misunderstood by her critics, right, who again recognized her power as a writer, but who couldn't grasp the theological vision that animated her craft. In a letter to a friend, she famously wrote, "Everyone who has read Wise Blood thinks I'm a hillbilly nihilist, whereas I would like to create the impression that I'm a hillbilly Thomist." Now, I know a good many Thomists, none in this room, who find this unbelievable because her fiction is so grotesque in the literary sense of that term. But it's not just crusty Thomists who struggle to appreciate O'Connor. There's another famous writer that I greatly admire, Marilynne Robinson, who argues that Flannery has had a destructive influence on literature because she, quote, doesn't respect religious thought. And while, quote, her prose is beautiful, her imagination appalls me. Robinson explains that she finds O'Connor's fictional imagination cruel, and that she doesn't find any compensatory impulses in her fiction that would dignify the characters whom she treats so badly. She also noted that as a teacher, she has to unteach Flannery's influence all the time, warning her students, "Do not make characters only so that you can ridicule them. Do not make characters who will just be your victims." This abject failure to perceive the action of grace in Flannery's writing is pretty pervasive, I think. Now, it's true that O'Connor's stories are darkly funny. They are tinged with ignorance, violence, cruelty, and a level of freakishness that does, at first glance, seem far afield from those virtues or stable perfections that Thomas Aquinas argued were necessary to know and love God and keep his commandments. Her characters are typically Protestant, display obvious vices, and engage in forms of religiosity that are both mawkish and wild. What then is Thomist about her fiction? Well, I think she's a Thomist about art, and I'll talk a lot more about that later today. But for now, I'll just note that O'Connor argues that the dramatic judgments of the fiction writer are informed by her broader vision of reality, most especially her vision of the human person and its relation to what she would call creation. So the content of what she writes reflects her vision of the way things are, which means that the cultivation of the artist includes the cultivation of a vision that is broad, deep, and truthful to reality, if the art is going to be great. There is no other way for the novelist to deliver what O'Connor thinks she ought, which is, and this is a quote, within the form of the book, a total experience of human nature at any time. So the great artist must have vision in the sense that she's able to communicate this vision through her art. But in some sense, this truthful vision is external to her art, right? Perhaps in a way analogous to how grace illumines the intellect and the virtue of faith. I'll talk more about that later. The truthful vision that does clearly animate her fiction she gets from Aquinas, which again she read habitually every evening beginning in high school. According to Aquinas's vision of the human person, we're created in the image of God and naturally ordained to our own perfection or happiness through the use of our rational capacities. But our work during our pilgrimage on earth is to freely cooperate with God's grace so that we can attain this supernatural and beatifying end. We're fallen through sin, we need grace to see the world as it really is, and we need grace to be capable of loving and knowing God as he is in himself. This grace is totally unmerited. God loves us and calls us to himself, even as we are busy rejecting him and distracting ourselves with lesser goods. She also takes from Aquinas what she calls her Christian realism. For Thomas, what it means to live well as a human person is, first and foremost, to know and love reality and to seek and conform oneself to what is true so that one can have loving communion with the good and take one's delight in what is beautiful. The true, the good, and the beautiful are, for Thomas, just different ways a person can be related to reality. And of course, God is the ultimate reality. His essence is his existence, which means that God is truth, beauty, and goodness itself, and human perfection is found in communion with this highest good. Reality includes both God's creation as communicative of and ordered to his own goodness and God's activity in sustaining creation in its being and working to bring it back to himself. Nature is created and is therefore infused with natural meaning and purpose. Again, it's not just so much stuff for our use, but rather a good that we are called to both understand and respect. The Christian must never try to hide from reality, but always to live in conformity with it. This is often difficult for us. Reality can be a tough master, as O'Connor clearly realizes. To live and persist in sin is simply to prefer our own fantasies to what is real and enduring. O'Connor sees that the temptation to resist, ignore, or distract oneself from reality is constant. It is central to her vision of grace, which is God's work in the Holy Spirit to bring us back to himself, that it works to pierce the veil of perception, to help us to see the world as it really is, and to force us to confront it, most especially to confront the unpleasant reality of the effects of sin in our own souls. For O'Connor, sin is real, and sin is rupture between man and God. That rupture can only be healed through grace, which heals, elevates, and perfects our nature. The idea that God's grace can help us to see reality, including the reality of the incarnation as our redemption and salvation, is a theme of O'Connor's fiction. She once wrote that she was always irritated by people who imply that writing fiction is an escape from reality. No, it is a plunge into reality, and it is very shocking to the system. Flannery thought her readers were coarsened and that it would take something drastic to get them to see the reality to which she wanted to point them towards. As a Catholic writer whose audience is largely secular, she felt she needed to shock. This was strategic and intentional on her part. So this is a quote from her. When you can assume that your audience holds the same beliefs you do, you can relax and use more normal means of talking to it. When you have to assume that it does not, then you have to make your vision apparent by shock. To the hard of hearing, you shout. For the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures. O'Connor further insists that morality for an artist lies in his vision that she can communicate, not in a lesson, either theological or moral. She would fully agree with Nabokov that great literature is not meant to be didactic. If the writer is a successful artist, his moral judgment will coincide with his dramatic judgment. It will be inseparable from the very act of seeing. Finally, for O'Connor, there is a deeply incarnational aspect of art. The spiritual is materially realized. The truth of fiction is not given in abstract principles, but in the experiential context of the material of a particular story with particular characters. In the incarnation, divine spirit becomes embodied in human flesh. Likewise, in fiction, sacred truths become enmattered in the specific circumstances and materials of the profane story, right? So vision is of the perceptual realm. It pertains to particulars. This is why a moral vision can never be fully captured in philosophy or theology, which is of necessity abstract and universal. A true moral vision requires art, and most especially literature and storytelling. It's no accident that sacred scripture is full of stories. Fundamentally, Flannery's fiction points us to the need for redemption. And the key to understanding her fiction is a combination of grasping the sacramental character of her imagery and symbols and the dramatic action of grace in her stories. And this is what most readers and critics miss. A bull that gores a woman trying to kill him is an image of divine charity. A missing leg might be a symbol of pride and the need for humility. A tattoo might be an icon and a symbol of the power of beauty to lead us to the divine. And a terminal illness might be the means of a new life in grace. But what Flannery never wanted us to lose sight of is the price of this redemption or restoration, which is evil and sin. People thought she was a hillbilly nihilist because her characters are freaks and misfits, caught in self-destructive patterns and forms of stupidity. But what her critics missed was, again, her theological vision, which has it that sin is real. Its consequences are deadly, though often comically so, and that grace is necessary for us to see the world and live freely. This, I think, is really the essence of her hillbilly Thomism, the need for the life of grace in which all will be glorified, renewed, and redeemed in the wise blood that flows from the redemptive act on the cross. So let's get into a story. Good Man is Hard to Find. Who's read it? Okay. okay, so I've said a bunch of stuff, and now I want to kind of just show or demonstrate my case. And I picked A Good Man is Hard to Find because I think it's her most famous story, and it's short. So this is a story of God's grace extended to someone outside the sacraments in order to effect profound changes. It is a comically dark story. I find the story hilarious until the very end, and then you want to die. but it's a comically dark story of mishaps, misfits, violence, and, I think, merciful redemption. So we're introduced to a family that's preparing to embark on a road trip. There's a grandmother, Bailey, her son, and his wife, and their three children, and a cat that's not supposed to be there. They're headed to Florida, but the grandmother is constantly needling Bailey to go to Tennessee instead. She starts to make her case against Florida by pointing out that there's this fellow that calls himself the Misfit, is loose from the federal pen and headed towards Florida. I wouldn't take my children in any direction with a criminal like that, a loose in it. I couldn't answer to my conscience if I did. This is a scene that sets up the central irony of the story, because of course it will be the grandmother who leads the family straight to the Misfit out of her own stupidity and pride. So the grandmother pretends that she wants to stay home, but everyone, especially the children, call her bluff, and sure enough, the next morning, the grandmother is the first person dressed and ready in the car. She has snuck her cat into a big black suitcase, even though Bailey, like, expressly forbids this. No cat. The grandmother is described as wearing white cotton gloves, a navy blue straw sailor hat with a bunch of white violets on the brim, and a navy blue dress with a small white dot in the print. Her collars and cuffs were white organdy trimmed with lace, and at her neckline she had pinned a purple spray of cloth violets containing a sachet. Why is she so dressed up? In case of an accident, anyone seeing her dead on the highway would know at once that she was a real lady. Now, along the way, the grandmother gets it into her head that they are close to a plantation she visited as a child. And the more she reminisced about it, the stronger her desire was to see it. She began to tell the children of a secret panel in the house where the family hid their silver from Sherman and his troops during the war, a feature that she wished were true, as it clearly excited the children. But it was not. She convinces Bailey to travel down the dirt road to this supposed plantation. But along the road, a horrible thought comes to her that is so upsetting that she knocks over her suitcase and the cat leaps out and attacks Bailey, who subsequently wrecks the car. The grandmother's horrible thought was that the plantation she so vividly recalled was not in Georgia at all, but in East Tennessee. The car is now inoperable. In a few minutes, a car comes along the road and the grandmother flags it down. There are three men inside. The driver looks down with a steady, expressionless gaze. He is shirtless, wearing spectacles and ill-fitting and mismatched clothes. The grandmother immediately identifies him. "You're the misfit. I recognized you at once." "Yes, ma'am," the man says, smiling. "But it would have been better for all of you, lady, if you hadn't recognized me." In this act, we know for certain that the grandmother has now sealed their doom. But the grandmother attempts to appeal to his sense of Southern propriety. "You wouldn't shoot a lady, would you?" the grandmother asks. "I would hate to have to," the misfit replies. She keeps telling the misfit that he's a good man, where this means that he doesn't have common blood. She assures him repeatedly that she knows that he comes from nice people and asks him comically whether he wouldn't prefer to settle down and live a nice, comfortable life. The entire scene that unfolds here is darkly comic. One can't help but be amused by the grandmother's behavior, as one is simultaneously horrified by the reality of the situation she has put them in. And the misfit is well-mannered, even as he is clearly the angel of death come to take them. But he is respectful about it. He even chastises Bailey for swearing at his mother, but in a gentle and patient way. Bailey is taken to the woods along with his young son to be shot by the misfit's men. Upon their disappearance, the grandmother asks the misfit if he ever prays, and she assures him that Jesus would help him if he did. But the misfit replies, "I don't want no help. I'm doing all right by myself." The misfit's men come out of the woods with Bailey's shirt for the misfit to put on. The grandmother is in such a condition by this point that she couldn't even name what the shirt reminded her of. She, like the misfit, confesses that she cannot remember what she has done. The misfit politely asks Bailey's wife if she and her daughter would like to join her husband in the woods, leaving the grandmother and the misfit alone together. And at this point, the grandmother is no longer able to speak except to say the name of Jesus over and over again. The misfit explains to the grandmother that he calls himself the misfit because I can't make sense of what all I done wrong and make it fit with all I gone through in punishment. And he asks her, "Does it seem right to you, lady, that one is punished a heap and another ain't punished at all?" To his theological query about guilt and retribution, the grandmother continues to insist that he shouldn't shoot a lady and that he comes from nice people. And for good measure, she adds that she'll give him all the money she has if he will simply spare her life. And then she hears two more gunshots coming from the woods. At this point, the misfit looks her squarely in the eyes and says, and now I will read from the last little bit of the story because it's so great. He says, "Jesus thrown everything off balance. It was the same case with him as with me, except he hadn't committed any crime that they could prove. I had committed one because they had the papers on me. Of course," he said, "they never shown me my papers. That's why I signed myself now. I said long ago, you get you a signature and sign everything you do and keep a copy of it. Then you'll know what you done and you can hold up the crime to the punishment and see do they match. And in the end, you'll have something to prove you ain't been treated right. I call myself the misfit," he said, "because I can't make what all I done wrong fit with all I'd gone through and punishment, right? And then he says, Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead, and he shouldn't have done it. He'd thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you've got left the best way you can, by killing somebody, or burning down his house, or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure, but meanness, he said, and his voice had become almost a snarl. Maybe he didn't raise the dead, the old lady mumbled, not knowing what she was saying, and feeling so dizzy that she sank down in the ditch with her legs twisted under her. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wished I had been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I'd have been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice. If I'd have been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own, as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her 3 times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them. Hiram and Bobby Lee returned from the woods and stood over the ditch, looking down at the grandmother, who half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. Without his glasses, the misfit's eyes were red-rimmed and pale and defenseless looking. "Take her off and throw her where you've thrown the others," he said, picking up the cat that was rubbing itself against his leg. "She was a talker, weren't she?" Bobby Lee said, sliding down the ditch with a yodel. "She would have been a good woman," the misfit said, "if there had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life." "Some fun," Bobby Lee said. "Shut up, Bobby Lee," the misfit said. "It's no real pleasure in life." That's the end of the story. It seems fairly grim. Now, in one sense, the story ends exactly as we've known all along that it would. The grandmother's murdered by the misfit on account of her own lack of good sense. But what we didn't expect, and what the misfit clearly didn't expect, was for the misfit to make himself vulnerable to her, to express his own desire for faith and his despair in the fact of its absence and what the lack of faith has done to him. And in that moment of vulnerability, for the grandmother to see him as one of her own children, to recognize his wounded humanity and to respond with the tenderness of a mother's love, which is both totally unmerited and totally necessary. And that revelation, that moment of seeing him in his essence as a child of God, just like one of her own, and responding appropriately, makes him lash out in violence. He feels attacked by this expression of charity towards him, and he kills her. In this moment, though, the moment of her death, the grandmother is, I think, utterly transformed by God's grace. She has died with a smile on her face and the posture of an innocent child. The misfit has, in this moment, become an unwitting instrument of God's action in the world, redeeming the grandmother in spite of himself. And just as the grandmother has seen the misfit for the first time for who he really is, likewise, he takes off his glasses and his eyes have changed. They are no longer, as they were, steady and expressionless and intent on murder, but red-rimmed and pale and defenseless. He, too, has been changed by this encounter. And as he cleanses the grandmother's blood from his glasses, we are meant to wonder to the extent to which he, too, will see things differently now, and perhaps more clearly. We are led to wonder whether her blood is the first step to his own redemption. And so it is then no surprise that he expresses disgust that one of his men would take pleasure in their murderous afternoon. "It's no real pleasure in life," he chastises them, backing away from the nihilism he had just professed. Here we see a vision of grace that displays the power of God to work a change in us, in spite of our sins and our dispositions to sin. That God's love has the power to break us out of our complacency. In the grandmother's case, her self-image as a Southern lady, which narrows her vision of other people, seeing them as they fit within the class structure of an old South she longs to bring back. And in the Misfits case, his image of himself as cut off from God's love and providential care, as someone whose main goal is to escape the structures of judgment and punishment in order to live freely, to pursue the pleasure of meanness. In the final moments of the story, the action of grace does give us a sense of the dramatic, the tragic, and the infinite. It does fill us with grief, but above grief, wonder at the goodness of God and his infinite love and mercy for human beings. In all of Flannery O'Connor's stories, there are moments of profound change, moments of grace at work in the world. This grace is not always accepted, but it is offered. And grace does often work to clarify the vision of her characters. It works to pierce the veil of self-deception for people who are humorously ignorant of their own defects of soul, making those defects manifest to them in extraordinary ways. It is this manifestation that is necessary for any hope of change. And I will give the last word to Flannery here. She said, "I'm mighty tired of reading reviews that call a good man brutal and sarcastic. These stories are hard, but they are hard because there is nothing harder or less sentimental than Christian realism. The truth is, my stories have been watered and fed by dogma. I am a Catholic, and at some point in my life, I realized not only was I a Catholic, but this was all I was. That I was a Catholic, not like somebody else would be a Baptist or a Methodist, but like someone else would be an atheist. If my stories are complete, it is because I see everything as beginning with original sin, taking in the redemption and reckoning on a final judgment." Thanks for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.